This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. With Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence, and we got lots of questions. Questions come to us via radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. That's where you can send your questions that pertain to nutrition, any aspect of health, high-tech medical developments. That's the turf that we cover here on Intelligent Medicine. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And, you know, I just want to share this article with you before we address questions. And it comes to us from Science News. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying here is that a lot of the messaging, the bad messaging about food, is aimed at children and adolescents.
And yeah, the marketing of all kinds of,
you know, clearly,
junk.
I mean, we know that that's a big problem. They're a vulnerable population.
Yeah.
They're often given, propaganda, literally propaganda, that makes them feel that it's socially acceptable to eat a lot of junky food and that it is the in thing to do. And, you know, it's like, you know, they show beautiful people, beautiful kids, handsome, attractive people, thin. Consuming stuff that's obviously very bad for you. So that's what we're up against. And so public health messaging that attempts to make kids more wary consumers has fallen flat.
Yes.
It sounds preachy. You know, it's kind of like the stuff we got in home ec or whatever we got, in high school. You know, don't eat that bad stuff. It sounds very... preachy.
Your health course in high school or junior high.
Whatever they call it, hygiene, health, they throw in some sex education, and they try and make you more aware, and, you know, you're bored, and the ads are so much more glitzy and appealing. Well, they did a very interesting study, and I think this really keys in, I think, to our Intelligent Medicine mission statement here, is they tried to... You know, one of the characteristics of teenagers, and especially teen boys, is their rebelliousness. And what they tried to do with their awareness campaign about junk food ads is they tried to key into the rebelliousness of these and skepticism of these teenagers.
Ah.
And teenagers are a rebellious and skeptical lot. They challenge authority. And so that was the theme of the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers find diets improve when tapping adolescents' desire to rebel. Teenage boys cut back junk food purchases by 31%, which is very cool.
Good for teenage boys.
Yeah, so they had actually, the intervention was they gave the usual materials, you know, sort of preachy materials about how bad junk food is for you, versus kind of a jazzier campaign. That got kids to read a fact-based expose-style article on big food companies.
Oh.
The article framed the corporations as manipulative marketers trying to hook consumers on addictive junk food for financial gains. The stories also described deceptive product labels and advertising practices that target vulnerable populations, including very young children and the poor. They found the effects were particularly impressive among boys who reduced their daily purchases of unhealthy drinks and snacks in the school cafeteria by 31% in that time period compared with the control group. Now, don't you see some similarities between that intervention and the intervention that we do on a weekly and daily basis with our podcast here on Intelligent Medicine, right?
Your taste buds are being hijacked.
Exactly.
All of that, right.
So, but the messaging that we do also appeals to, I think, the skeptical and rebellious nature of our constituency.
Yes.
Which is, you know, an aware audience of, you know, probably not, you know, kids, teenagers, but mostly adults, mature adults, who take a sort of a skeptical view towards the mainstream, the mainstream politics, the mainstream culture, the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always tend to, and this is how I was raised. I always kind of look behind the curtain. And, you know, I think...
Look for the wizard.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And, you know, my parents took a very skeptical view towards the mainstream culture.
Yeah.
And I think I inherited that particular strain, and I apply it in my investigations of various scams that are perpetuated by the pharmaceutical industry, by the food industry, by the medical industrial complex. This is the spirit of intelligent medicine, actually, in this little intervention.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of cool.
Appealing to their, you know, their critical thinking. Appealing to, and using, psychologically using their rebellious nature at that age. I think that's brilliant.
And I actually remember, and I don't remember that much about high school, but I do remember I had a great social studies teacher. And I actually just read a recent obituary of him. He's quite old and he died. Oh. But, you know, of course, when I was like, you know, 14 or 15 years old, you know, this guy was, you know, like a 35 or 40 year old guy, you know, but
he was an old guy,
but he was an old guy. He had a mustache and, but he was a very cool guy. He always dressed cool, but he actually had, I remember a class where he said, here are some advertisements. I want you to get behind these advertisements and tell me about the deception. And there was also a guy.
That's pretty forward thinking.
Yeah. Well, there actually was a book. That was on my parents' bookshelf. I remember it was in our den. And it was called, it was by Vance Packard. And Vance Packard wrote in the 1950s or 1960s, he wrote a book, I think, called The Deceptures or something like that. About how Madison Avenue, you know, Mad Men, a la Mad Men.
Yeah.
It was an expose about how Madison Avenue manipulated Americans' taste and preferences. You know, I'll look it up here because
fascinating.
But so really, this is, I think, a tradition in America. You know, it dates back to like people like Mark Twain, you know, and social critics. You know, this skepticism that we bring to mainstream culture that I think it's part of our intelligent medicine orientation.
Yes, yes.
Hidden Persuaders is the book.
Hidden Persuaders.
Hidden Persuaders book. He was an American, Vance Packard. And he was the author of several books, including The Hidden Persuaders. And The Hidden Persuaders was, you know, an expose of advertising manipulation. Written, I'm just looking it up, 1957.
Wow.
In those sort of quiet 50s, there were wellsprings of creativity and pushback against popular culture, as homogenized as it was in the 1950s.
Wow. Fascinating. As opposed to many children who grew up believing, because of their parents, that everything written in the newspaper is truth.
Yeah, right.
Not to be questioned.
Right, right.
I know some people like that.
Right.
Wow. So, anyway, interesting. So, marketing manipulation and teenage boys. Good for teenage boys.
We need to teach our kids critical thinking skills.
Yes.
And, you know, I hope that that's happening in schools. I wonder, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. I wonder, too. Great. Good stuff. Good stuff. Shall we get on to questions?
Yes, we shall.
We have an email from Nancy. Nancy writes, would like to know any side effects from a procedure done after removing a cancer mass. It's an MRI and dye injection, probably for contrast, right?
Right.
My father-in-law was told to do this every 3 months after a huge mass was removed from his stomach.
Yikes.
Nancy is asking, are they milking Medicare for this and causing another cancer mass?
Okay, well, first of all, when we're talking about MRIs, MRIs don't cause cancer.
No.
They're actually magnetic treatments. Whatever they cause, you know, is unclear, but the biggest problem associated with MRIs is the dye.
The
contrast is called gadolinium.
Mm.
And there is this condition called gadolinium deposition disease. And it's devastating. It can be deposited in the brain, in the nervous system, and it particularly happens when people have kidney problems or if they're older and they don't have good handling of excretion of this material. It's actually a magnetic material, gadolinium. It's a rare earth.
Yeah.
And it's a concern. You know, it actually is a concern if you have multiple MRIs, particularly where they want to use contrast. They don't have to use contrast. I mean, I had an MRI of my foot, and of course they didn't need to use contrast for my foot.
Mm-hmm.
So they just did an MRI. But, you know, if they want to show up, especially things in the central nervous system or, you know, things, structures in the abdomen, they'll do contrast.
Yeah. I had an MRI with contrast of my head to look at my inner ear because I had labyrinthitis that wouldn't go away.
Right, right.
So they were looking for acoustic neuroma. They found none.
They would need to use contrast for something that finely discriminating.
But I remember being asked, do you have any history of kidney disease or anything like that
right.
at the time? This was about 25 years ago.
So the answer is, I mean, there is a concern about cumulative exposure of an elderly individual, particularly with compromised kidney function, with gadolinium exposure.
Yeah.
As to their As to their motives, you know, look, this speaks to a great deal of suspicion that people have of the medical profession. The medical profession, it's almost like given a potential possibility for reimbursement, you know, an entitlement for, like, you're entitled to x-ray this patient, you know, 4 times a year for this particular condition.
Yeah.
That they will probably x-ray the person for, because you're entitled to, and they're going to...
And you're going to get paid for it.
They're going to back into that reimbursement, whether or not it's clinically indicated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is conceivably possible.
That leads to integrity.
But it is also possible that this guy had a mask. We don't know what kind of mask this was.
Yeah.
Probably a cancerous mask, and they just want to make sure that it's not going to come back.
Yeah.
Now, when you are told... You need the scan, you need the scan, you need the scan. You need to ask some questions. You need to say, well, why are we doing the scan? And of course, the obvious retort would be to see if the cancer is coming back.
Yeah.
But the next question, you know, usually that stops patients. They go, okay, I got it. You know, got
to see. Want to make sure.
The next question is, so what difference does it make? How will it aid our decision, you know, about the cancer? I mean, it is conceivable that additional surgery could remove the, you know, the cancer that's come back, and that will improve survival.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that additional treatments, radiation or chemo or immunotherapy could make a big difference with this particular cancer. Or it could be like, hey, if the cancer comes back, you're pretty much out of luck. And it's not going to make a difference in your clinical course.
Yeah.
In which case, you can elect, to the doctor's chagrin, to say, hey, if it doesn't make a difference, why are we doing this test? Why subject me to the risk of this test? Do I need to know? I personally don't feel the need to know.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes back, I'll know it.
Mm-hmm.
End of story.
Hmm.
I mean, I think that that's a legitimate discussion to have with your doctor.
Right, right. Interesting.
And of course, doctors, primary care doctors anyway, should safeguard patients from unnecessary tests and procedures.
They are the gatekeepers.
They're the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
But specialists order. Specialists want to go, 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 go. The primary care doctor will say, thank you, consultant, for your opinion. I know this patient very well. I'm very acquainted with their mindset and with their long medical history.
Yeah.
And in the interest of my patient, I'm going to say no more.
Mm-hmm.
No more investigation.
Yeah. These are all good points. Wow. Wonderful. Nancy, we hope that answers your question. More conversation for your father to have with his doctor. Your father-in-law. Correction.
At this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So here goes.
Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com.
Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our questions. What's next, Layla?
We have from Carol an email. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I enjoy your podcast. So much good information. Thank you for listening, Carol. I have one question and one comment. Dr. Hoffman said he sometimes drinks seltzer. Is it okay to drink?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. You drink it all the time, right?
I guzzle seltzer. Yeah, I've got one of those machines.
Soda Stream,
I have
right?
a Soda Stream, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it okay to drink the flavored variety? I read the ingredients on the label only indicates flavored sparkling water with natural flavors. Any problems with this?
That could conceal a multitude of ills.
That's true.
Because, you know, number one, do you believe that these are really natural flavors? Is there sugar in it? You know, I think the best procedure would be to make a spritzer out of like a natural fruit juice.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know,
cause, add a tablespoon of your fruit juice, your pomegranate or something.
Or if you want, and this is something I do, is put in a little bit of stevia. And the product that I like these days for stevia flavoring is something called reacted magnesium.
Yes.
Because you're getting your magnesium and you're getting a nice stevia flavor. Mm-hmm. It's made by Orthomolecular. It's available in powder form. You can get it on full script. And then you get that sweetness. And just say, I mean, say you're using a little bit of, like, just a, you know, a couple of teaspoons of lemon essence or something like that. Well, that's just going to make it sour. So maybe you want to make it a little sweeter with the stevia. So
I love seltzer with lemon.
Just straight up lemon.
Just straight up lemon.
Wow.
Or lemon water. I find it delicious.
That's an acquired taste because a lot of people find lemonade is too tart.
Ah, okay. I don't call it lemonade, though. That would be very strong lemon. Just a little squeeze of lemon in a big glass of water.
Oh,
or
that's
seltzer.
That's like the Perrier with the lemon flavor that's without any sugar. Yeah.
Right.
Or you can get lemon, lime.
Yeah.
But then you got to schlep the bottle. So
that's
why not
true.
Just use your own fresh lemons and limes?
Use your own fresh lemons and limes. Why don't you just do that, Carol? Carol has a comment.
Yeah.
Based on an experience she had. She'd been getting an irritation around her mouth, extending to the upper lip, sometimes the chin. Went to the dermatologist and she said it is perioral dermatitis. Looked it up. And there was an indication that it may be a sensitivity to fluoride in toothpaste.
Okay.
And I've been using something advertised for gum health. And now here's the other thing. She was using a Crest product called Gum Detoxify.
Yikes.
Are you sitting down, Dr. Hoffman,
What's in it? What's in it?
Ingredients are water, sorbitol, hydrated silica, sodium lauryl sulfate, which is found carrageenan, sodium
which
gluconate.
Could be very irritating.
Very irritating. Flavor, xanthan gum, zinc citrate, stannous chloride, sodium saccharin.
Stannous chloride is actually a tin compound. Stannous chloride?
Stannous chloride.
Stannous is actually designed to reduce gum sensitivity.
Ah, okay. Okay. Sodium saccharin, sodium hydroxide.
Saccharin, which is not...
Titanium oxide.
Which is an abrasion.
Very
abrasive. Yeah.
Yeah. Active ingredients is stannous fluoride. Okay. Stannous fluoride.
Fluoride.
Which, yeah, fluoride, I think she meant to say.
Fluoride, yeah. Because stannous fluoride would be something that supposedly hardens the teeth in enamel.
Mm. Yeah. I've heard of people getting acne around their mouth and chin because they changed to a different brand of toothpaste or one that says tartar control or some other kind of...
Why don't you use Spry toothpaste?
Just use Spry.
Yeah, exactly. Spry is the is the xylitol toothpaste. Mm-hmm. And that actually inhibits the biofilms, which adhere to the tooth surface, but also the gums, you know, responsible for periodontal disease.
Yeah.
And that's a good one.
That's a good one.
And you don't have to have
go
the fluoride.
Spry.
I now use fluoride-free toothpaste. We get enough fluoride.
You do.
Because they fluoridate the water, and they fluoridate, like a lot of, you know, canned goods and beverages have fluoride in them.
Yes. Yes.
Although I don't have a lot of canned goods and beverages.
There you go. So you want to be able to avoid that as well. Carol, thank you for the question. Thank you for the comment. And yes, stop using that stuff. I would move over to Spry. Even something like a Tom's of Maine natural toothpaste has titanium dioxide in it.
Which is bad for our patients who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, any kind of gastrointestinal inflammatory condition.
Yeah.
You know, the other possibility, perioral dermatitis, we ought to check the diet because we do find patients who sometimes have that sort of reddish halo around their oral cavity. It could be a food. And what are some of the foods that are particularly implicated in that? I find citrus,
stone fruits, plums, peaches, cherries,
right.
Things like that may cause irritation.
Perioral dermatitis.
If there's more irritation around the corners, you know, we look for B vitamin deficiencies, possibly.
And we also look for, you know, frankly, fungal infections. Like it can be a manifestation of oral thrush. Is, you know, redness around the mouth, cracking here in the margins of the.
Yeah.
Mouth.
Chronic
B vitamin deficiency.
Yeah, chronic lip smacking and all of that. If you find your lips are too dry and you keep, you know, trying to moisten your lips with your tongue over and over and over and over again, that becomes chronic. That could cause dryness and cracking over time.
Right.
Some people are addicted to their chapstick.
With harmful potential ingredients. You know, what I find helpful is, you know, coconut oil can be helpful.
Yeah.
It also has a little bit of an antifungal effect, should that be the case.
Manuka.
Manuka is also good.
I love
good.
Manuka
Manuka's
for that.
Good.
That's a very nice idea.
Good.
And the most important thing, get rid of the offending substance that's causing all of that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. We have an email from Cheryl. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm a Whole30 diet graduate. I've done well eliminating grains and beans, and I'm still adhering to that part of the diet. I've added back organic Greek yogurt because it doesn't bother me, and it has benefits. My question is, what do you think of using nut flours like coconut and almond for baking, like making high-protein muffins with nut flour and protein powder? Will this raise insulin levels because it's processed? I don't want to risk it if it does.
Well, that's a little bit in your wheelhouse, but you know what I would say is, you know, especially for our patients who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease or diverticulitis, they're on a specific carbohydrate diet, or for autistic kids, you know, we find the nut flours give people a break because they
add the grain-like texture back.
So they can be made into cookies or
biscottis and muffins and breads.
Right.
All kinds of things. You can make a zucchini bread or a banana bread using nut flours.
But would you think it's going to make you fat, or it's going to cause you metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance?
Well, it depends on what other ingredients you're using. Are you using a lot of sugar in these particular products?
Hopefully not.
Are you, anything like that? Do you have an allergy to said nuts or anything?
And that's possible too.
And why would you add a protein powder to it? There is some protein in the nuts. You're getting protein if you're on the Whole30, and you're getting plenty of protein. There's no reason to add protein powder to something like this.
Right.
I don't see a problem. It depends on what else you add to it and how often you consume these. I will say...
Do you think the person might benefit from a custom nutritional consult?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because
absolutely.
We want to know a little bit about their
Yeah.
You know, the characteristics, do a physical exam, do maybe a body composition analysis, maybe mm-hmm. look at their hemoglobin A1C, look at their genetics and mm-hmm. insulin.
See what may be going on there.
What I'm discovering, and this is something going to roll out later this year, is the potential for genetic testing to explain why some people cannot achieve their optimal hemoglobin A1C. There's a lot going on in both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and more so than we thought. It's not just insulin resistance. There's a lot of interplay among different factors that are genetic that can predict whether you're at risk.
Wow, wow. But as an aside about the hemoglobin A1C, I was asked this question recently. It's only an average.
Right.
It doesn't take care of the outliers, the extreme highs, the extreme lows.
I wonder, for that, we use the glycomark.
Yeah, the glycomark. I wonder
that's
if there's
a test
any...
that tells you mm-hmm. how much you're fluctuating.
Yes, what the variability is. Right. So that could be another important test if Cheryl is looking for...
Or, you know, some people are doing CGMs, continuous glucose monitors. Look, it sounds a little OCD, but, you know, if you want to do some self-study on how you react to foods, that's the ultimate way. Of course, you can also do finger sticks, but that's, a little bit of a nuisance. And, but some people... his family member of mine, she was pregnant. She was diagnosed with gestational diabetes. She really got it under control by self-testing with a little glucometer. She found which food she reacted to and which food she did not. I will point out there's an amazing, amazing test called Day 2. And Day 2 predicts glycemic responses for individualized because it's different for everybody. Based on a stool sample, based on your microbiome, it's actually very accurate. Surprising so. Israeli researchers at the Weizmann Institute devised it. It's available.
Wow.
Yeah, it's available.
Day two.
Yeah, it's something that's quite an interesting way of, say you have paradoxical reactions. Wheat products, but you have a horrible reaction to carrots.
Mm. Carrots can be high glycemic, whereas a whole grain wheat may be lower.
Right.
That's interesting.
Right. So it'll predict that because there's a great deal of inter-individual variability in terms of the glycemic. It's not a one-size-fits-all concept.
Yeah.
It has to be tailored to the individual. Anyway, we have to pause.
Oh, my. Okay.
Because... we divide these podcasts into two parts, as many of you know, mm-hmm. and we're at the end of the line for part one. Give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
My dad has glaucoma in both eyes and was advised not to do any weight training.
We'll address that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hobben today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Radio program at AOL.com for questions. We'll see you on side two.